With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here, and thanks for getting your agricultural news with me today. The 104th California Farm Bureau Annual Meeting, Leading Through Solutions, is coming up in just a few short days. The meeting kickstarts on December 2nd with the Young Farmers and Ranchers State Conference. It will feature agricultural tours, educational workshops, the new California Marketplace, keynote speakers, and much more. I'll be there covering the meeting, so please stop by and say hello and tell me where you're listening from. And now to start off our show today with our first headline, also coming from the California Farm Bureau. California currently has an estimated 7.35 million acres of irrigated cropland, of which 460,000 acres, or 6%, is certified as organic. The European Union policy's goal to exponentially increase organic farming to 30% of all agricultural production by 2030 is likely to be pursued by Governor Gavin Newsom. But recently, a study showed that if farmers transition to organics, it could increase food prices for consumers and shrink the profits for the producer. ERA Economics looked at the potential challenges with the EU standards to one California crop of tomatoes. The state produces 95% of America's processing tomatoes valued at $1.2 billion. Only 5% of California's 228,000 processing tomato acres is currently needed to meet the consumer demand for organic. The study found that reaching 30% of organic production by 2030 would increase the farm gate price of conventional tomatoes by more than 11%. It would also put the market price below the cost of production. California Farm Bureau President Jamie Johansson says, quote, "Farming works when we are able to grow what the consumer actually wants and not what the government mandates. California consumers are already struggling to afford higher prices for food than other states because of government mandates, and these types of proposals are just making things worse." He added, quote, "When the government increases the price of food, it acts like a regressive tax, hurting lower and middle-income families the hardest. At the end of the day, the government needs to let organic markets grow organically." And now here's Brian German with more agriculture news.
At the recent Sustainable Ag Expo, Assistant Grower Relations Representative for Justin Vineyards and Winery, Evelyn Alvarez Mendoza, presented some research findings on work looking to better understand fungicide resistance of botrytis in Central Coast wine grapes.
The actual idea for conducting the study was brought up by my graduate advisor, Dr. Shunping Ding. The study itself was funded by the CSU ARI. In bigger picture, the study was really conducted in a laboratory setting, but I obtained samples from the field, so from 8 different vineyards located throughout the Central Coast. And the idea, what powered this study, was the fact that there is a huge knowledge gap in the current literature right now and information regarding fungicide resistance in botrytis scenario populations on wine grapes here in the Central Coast region of California. There's plenty of literature out there that has been, similar studies been conducted in different regions of the world, even on wine grapes, but in different areas. However, the California Central Coast region is one of those where that information was absent before the study was conducted. So I evaluated 6 different mode of actions, and the ones that clearly, and this also coincides with other current literature out there, were FRAX 9 and 11. 11 specifically, the fungicide I looked at for that FRAC code was Flint. And then for FRAC 9, I specifically looked at Scala. So those two mode of actions have already known resistance to not only botrytis scenario, other pathogens as well, but botrytis scenario for sure is one of the more prominent ones that these two FRACs have documented resistance to.
The Almond Alliance of California has partnered with Great Valley Seed to help the almond industry better support pollinator health. The partnership seeks to develop native plant and seed supplies and make them easily accessible to the state's almond growers and expand pollinator habitat on 7,600 working farms. The new initiative, known as the Pollinator Alliance, gives farmers access to pricing, grants, and other programs designed to increase the long-term benefits for farmers who incorporate pollinator habitat into their operations. The partnership between Almond Alliance and Great Valley Seed will harness the expertise, experience, and commitment of the state's agriculturalists to develop a new capacity for installing pollinator habitat on ag lands. Farmers can sign up for more information about the financial and technical assistance they're eligible to receive at pollinatoralliance.farm. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Farm employers' labor service compliance posters could save you thousands of dollars. Did you know that California lawmakers can be fined as much as $13,000 in government penalties if they don't have all the required employee and farm labor information posted for their workers? Avoid costly penalties and give yourself peace of mind knowing you are in full compliance with FELS posters. At only $175, this full set of laminated weatherproof posters eliminates the risk. Order yours at FELS.net.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
In today's National Spotlight, with the elections in the rearview mirror, it's time to start looking ahead to the business of the next 2 years. There will be a different look in Congress as the Republicans gained control of the House of Representatives. That means new committee leadership as well. Pennsylvania Republican G.T. Thompson will take over as leader of the House Ag Committee. This means, with Democrats controlling the Senate, there will likely be more debate on the upcoming 2023 Farm Bill. This legislation is the largest agricultural and food policy in the United States. Iowa Republican Senator and Senate Ag Committee member Joni Ernst says both committees would like to see it done by the middle of next year. She's also pleased to see Senator Chuck Grassley will be rejoining her on the committee.
We have actually started working on the Farm Bill, so it's been very good to start those initial meetings and understand a path forward. And we know how important this is to our Iowa farmers and ranchers, so we'll be very diligent. We are blessed, of course, to have Senator Chuck Grassley back with us in this next Congress, and he also serves on our Agricultural Committee. So we'll be working very hard to make sure our Iowa interests are represented on that committee as we're working on this reauthorization. So exciting times there.
Crop insurance and the ag safety net are always controversial topics, even in the years when prices are bad. The issue now is that prices have increased, but input costs have as well. And those input costs are eating back into the higher margins farmers enjoyed the last couple of years. Ernst talks about why it's important to keep this safety net in place and why lawmakers need to understand that the need for these programs goes beyond commodity prices.
A lot of folks see those higher commodity prices and they think that farmers are getting rich. And we know that that's not true with the input costs. And so we're gathering up all of that information from our farmers and from the co-ops and so forth, and just helping paint a picture for the other members on our agricultural committee. Many of them do understand what is going on in our farm communities right now, but it's a lot of those other members that maybe don't serve on the agriculture committee. And so we have to do a very good job at painting a picture on why we really need this reauthorization.
The Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, is also a point where lawmakers tend to have disagreements. Former House Ag Committee Chairman Colin Peterson once said that without the SNAP titles in the bill, there wouldn't be enough support to handle the legislation needed for agriculture. Ernst says it's important to look at these programs, especially as inflation is eating away at the level of donations to food banks and the value for each dollar spent to help those less fortunate. Ernst says that lawmakers need to see to it that people get the assistance they need, and that the administration needs to admit that there is an economic issue, she says, instead of continually downplaying the situation.
Because we have seen inflation just rip through our communities and all across the United States. I just did a visit with the Open Door Mission, and they were talking about how difficult it is this year. They have increasing numbers of families that are coming to get donated food, and yet their donations are down as well because of the food costs. A lot of families just can't donate at the levels that they have in past years. And so a lot of families are really struggling with this. And they did talk about the USDA supports that they get to help some of their food programs. And we see this in our schools as well.
Farm Bill discussions will continue in earnest after the new Congress is seated in January. That's today's National Spotlight. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And now for today's livestock report, here's Randall Wiseman.
Well, in today's livestock news, last week, USDA announced a 45-day extension of the comment period for the proposed rule titled Inclusive Competition and Market Integrity under the Packers and Stockyards Act. And the National Cattlemen's Beef Association welcomed that extension. Their Senior Director of Government Affairs, Tanner Beamer, explains why it's so important.
This extension is very important for cattle producers because we need time to fully unpack this rulemaking. The filing spreads 180 pages of the Federal Register, and producers need to the opportunity to unpack all of those little nuances in the preamble and in the rule itself. We also need to respond. The rulemaking asked 44 specific questions to commenters and only gave folks 60 days to respond to those questions. If USDA is serious about wanting a robust set of comments from impacted stakeholders, from people who this rule would affect, then they need to allow them the appropriate amount of time to respond thoughtfully and holistically to the questions that they have asked and to whatever other unforeseen potential impacts could come as a result of this rulemaking. So the extension is very important to that end, but I still don't know that 45 days is quite enough time to allow us to do that. Also, you have to consider that this is one of several rules that the department has alluded to over the next couple years. And these rules all speak to one another, right? So they are all in the same section of the Code of Federal Regulations. They're going to play off of each other. And it's difficult for us to put together comprehensive comments on one rule when we don't know what the other ones are that are going to play off of each other in practice.
And as to what NCBA would like to see in this final rule, Beamer says one thing would be for USDA to tap the brakes.
Well, I think, first of all, we'd like to see him tap the brakes. Like I said, there are a lot of things to consider. There are quite literally decades of legislative, judicial, and regulatory history associated with this effort. And we would like for them to take a pause, engage with stakeholders, figure out where some of the blind spots may be in this rule before they proceed with some sort of finalization process. You know, ultimately, what we would like to see is something that is reflective of the original intent of the Packers and Stockyards and not an overreach by this department trying to assert themselves into the daily operations of the market.
You can learn more about this on the NCBA website, ncba.org. And last week, USDA announced plans for a Section 32 purchase of American Lamb products for distribution to various food nutrition assistant programs. The purchase was a request by the American Sheep Industry Association and the National Lamb Feeders Association earlier this year. ASI Executive Director Peter Orwick said, "We made the initial request back in the spring because we saw the supply issues starting to occur. We've since had numerous meetings with USDA and lamb companies in support of this purchase." I'm Randall Wiseman for Agnet West.
You're listening to Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Daniel Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Today's show is sponsored by the makers of All Grow Compost. It's the perfect amendment for improving your soil's water holding capacity. You can contact your soil health specialist, Tom Fantozzi, at 209-312-4016. Synagro, your partner for a cleaner, greener world. You've been listening to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Daniel Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
America's farmers contribute more to fighting world hunger than they might realize. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. Chase Sova is the Senior Director of Public Policy and Research with the World Food Program, which gets food to those going hungry around the world. Sova says America's farmers and their commodities play a big role in helping the battle against hunger.
Through the food aid programs in the United States, we've purchased about 10 million metric tons of grains and other commodities that are used in food aid programs, and it's reached over 300 million people around the world, and that's just in the last 10 years. All of this comes from the American heartland. It comes from farms. Frankly, it's something that the American farmer, I think, should be really proud of. You're really serving an important role. It's a win-win for American farmers who are finding markets for their products, but also helping to alleviate some of the worst hunger emergencies on the planet. So these commodities are still a big part of the U.S. food aid portfolio and a very important one.
I'm Sabrina Halverson for Agnet West.
Investing in farmland nationwide. With the story of how Farmland Partners was created, here is Vice President of Marketing with Farmland Trust, Philip Hayes.
So Farmland Partners is what's called a real estate investment trust, or a REIT. And most people are probably familiar with REITs as they apply to office buildings. So most of the office buildings in the country, most of the warehouses in the country, those are owned by REITs, which are publicly traded on a stock exchange. That concept has never really existed in agriculture. In fact, there's only two REITs in agriculture. There's one called Gladstone Land, which is a great company. They focus primarily on specialty cropland. And then there's Farmland Partners, which is my company. And Farmland Partners, we own about 160,000 acres across 18 different states, and it's really reflective of U.S. agriculture. So that includes specialty crops and also your corn and soybeans in the Midwest.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McGowan. About 3% or 35 million acres of U.S. ag land is owned by foreign entities or investors. The issue has become a larger concern in recent years. What laws govern foreign ownership of ag land? I'll get back to the report in a moment, but I want you to know that Schrader Real Estate and Auction Company has sold farm and ranch land and farm equipment in 40 states. Learn how the Schrader family can help your family. Visit SchraderAuction.com. That's S-C-H-R-A-D-E-R Auction.com. Federal law requires the reporting of foreign ag land ownership to help determine whether direct controls or limits on foreign investment need to be established. In 2017, legislation was introduced to create more accountability for the federal government's efforts to track foreign ownership. Legislation was also introduced in 2020 that would have strengthened USDA's monitoring capabilities. In late 2021, House passed legislation that would have required the USDA to bar the purchase of ag land by companies owned at least in part by China, Russia, or North Korea. A majority of states have rules limiting foreign ownership, but the restrictions tend to be minor and enforcement is not very effective. A new Indiana law prevents foreign businesses from owning more than 320 acres to be used for crop production. Any Russian business is completely barred from ownership of real estate through mid-2023. Often the cited reason for rules limiting foreign ownership of ag land is food and energy grid security. Energy companies are one of the largest groups of foreign investors. But there really hasn't been any change in federal law on foreign ownership of ag land since 1978. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McGowan.
Christmas trees will cost a bit more this year. If you're like me and you're buying a real Christmas tree this year, you should be prepared to pay more for it than you did last season. USDA's Gary Crawford talks with Tim O'Connor, who's the executive director of the National Christmas Tree Association.
Ah, a little hunting music. Very little hunting music. But if you are out hunting for a real Christmas tree this year, experts are saying with tight supplies of trees available, the sooner you do your tree hunting, the better. Everybody who wants a real tree will be able to have one. But finding one a few days before Christmas might take a little bit. So as to what we'll pay now for that tree this year compared to last,
we do think prices will be a little higher, maybe 5 to 10%.
Tim O'Connor with the National Christmas Tree Association says just like everybody else, Christmas tree growers are having to pay higher prices for what they need to produce the trees and operate their businesses.
Fuel's up 70%, fertilizer's up 300%, labor, equipment, parts, you name it, everything that a grower purchases are up.
And it's also costing a lot more to ship Christmas trees to local tree lots and retailers. Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
You're listening to Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Daniel Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Hello, I'm Zach Ducheneau, administrator for the USDA's Farm Service Agency. Voting is now open for the 2022 FSA County Committee elections, and that includes the urban county committees located in Albuquerque, Atlanta, Cleveland, Dallas, Minneapolis, St. Paul, New Orleans, Philadelphia, Phoenix, Portland, Richmond, and St. Louis. Now through December 5th, producers in eligible administrative areas can cast their votes for who will serve on their local FSA Urban Ag Committee. We're excited about these new committees, which are composed of local, urban, or suburban farmers who help us better support urban agriculture. Ballots for the 2022 elections were mailed to eligible voters the week of November 7th. If you did not receive your ballot by mail, you can request one from your local USDA Service Center. Ballots must be returned or postmarked no later than December 5th. For more information, visit fsa.usda.gov/elections or contact your local FSA office. Don't delay and vote today.
Welcome back to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West, providing you with statewide agriculture news daily. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Now let's listen in to more featured segments.
Urban agriculture. It's a term that might seem fairly new to some, but as Leslie Glover of the Agriculture Department's Office of Urban Agriculture and Innovative Production points out,
people have been growing food close to where they live ever since people have decided to settle down and live in one location,
including cities, especially in times of crisis. Yet with more urban producers growing a greater variety of crops for an expanding list of markets, the 2018 Farm Bill further established USDA's role in advancing urban agriculture, innovative production, and economic opportunity.
The Office of Urban Agriculture and Innovative Production, our mission is to encourage and promote urban, indoor, and other emerging agricultural practices, including community composting and food waste reduction.
I'm Rod Bain. Brian Gussie of the Office of Urban Ag and Innovative Production is among those joining us to discuss USDA's role in promoting urban agriculture in this edition of Agriculture USA. Urban agriculture, while to some may be a relatively new happening, has actually been around for several decades. Take, for instance, in the mid-1890s.
The Pingree potato patches.
Named after the mayor of Detroit, who developed potato patches during an economic crisis, meant to feed unemployed citizens who tended to these sustenance gardens. Leslie Glover says USDA has been involved in efforts going back to the war gardens of World War I and victory gardens of the Second World War.
All throughout the history of the U.S., there's been ups and downs with urban agriculture, and it's usually associated with hard times, and people recognize that there may be a need to go back and grow more food right where they live.
Glover is with USDA's Office of Urban Agriculture and Innovative Production. Over the past two decades, the recognition of urban agriculture and various advances such as hoop houses has led to not just sustenance growing, but economic opportunity for farmers in cities. That led to the development of the Office of Urban Ag and Innovative Production through the 2018 Farm Bill. Oversight for the office is provided by USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service. Brian Gussie of the office notes some of the tasks given to the agency as spelled out in the Farm Bill.
One was to create the Federal Advisory Committee for Urban Agriculture and Innovative Production to develop and administer and provide oversight to a number of competitive grant and cooperative agreement programs.
The Federal Advisory Committee began meetings this year.
The committee is by design supposed to advise the Secretary of Agriculture on the development of policies and outreach relating to urban, indoor, and other emerging agricultural production practices, as well as to identify any barriers to urban agriculture.
USDA Urban Agriculture and Innovative Production Grant Awards are provided in two project categories. Leslie Glover explains planting projects.
Really help to initiate or expand efforts where urban and suburban farmers or gardeners, regular citizens, are really looking to target those food access issues. To try to educate a new generation and connect them with agriculture, to help businesses that need some startup cost for new farming and for urban agroforestry in these areas, and then to help with zoning policies. We're trying to really help these different producers to navigate some of these policies.
While with the implementation project grants,
this is usually when work has already started, and we're really trying to help accelerate the work that these communities and organizations are already doing in some of these same areas.
Brian Gussie says also available as support from USDA, compost, and food waste reduction cooperative agreements.
That is primarily designed to provide support to municipal and local governments who are interested in developing either pilot programs or ongoing programs related to efforts to increase production of compost that would be then used to support urban agriculture and then also at the same time reducing food waste and loss.
In addition, there is the relaunch of USDA's People's Garden Initiative.
We're working very closely with a number of our state NRCS offices to establish people's gardens in a select number of cities.
Several of these cities are among the locations of USDA Farm Service Agency Urban County Committee pilots, bringing producer input, representation, and management of policies on the ground level. To learn more about USDA urban agriculture and innovative production efforts, information is available online, both at www.usda.gov/urban and farmers.gov/urban. This has been Agriculture USA. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Blue lies crying in the rain.
Hello, everybody out there in farm country. The radio commentary is brought to you by the National Corn Growers Association, Crop Life America, and the Renewable Fuels Association. They are friends, supporters, and allies of a healthy farm economy in prosperous rural America. And now for today's commentary. Throughout my lifetime, Thanksgiving has been a very important holiday, just behind Christmas. It's our opportunity to say thank you to our friends and to God. The first Thanksgiving celebration was in 1620. Our pilgrims landed on Cape Cod, and after the first harvest, they had a Thanksgiving dinner with the Indian tribe. We have reason to be thankful, as our nation has grown. With more than 300 million people, we are a global superpower. People from all over the world are scrambling to get to the United States any way they can. So thank you, God. We are grateful. Now, let's put on the table a few issues of the day. We have finished harvest, and now we need to ship the grain to customers that need it. And those customers are all over North America and the world. But a railroad strike is about to shut us down. Our government needs to take their threat seriously and make sure it doesn't happen. Okay, turn to Cuba, only 90 miles from Florida. We have a bipartisan congressional group in Cuba this week, and we need to expand our exports there. I have been to Cuba myself 4 times, trying to find a way to sell more of our ag products. They import most of their food, and as close as we are, we should be their source. Last subject, China. In Indonesia, at the Group 20 summit, President Biden and Chinese President Xi had their first face-to-face meeting since Biden was elected. They talked for 3 hours. The two most important, powerful nations in the world need to find a way to live together. Russia and Ukraine are at war. Europe and the United States are supporting Ukraine. We don't want China helping Russia. Also, we have a list of trade problems with China that we need to resolve. China is our biggest market for ag products, grain, and meat. President Trump imposed tariffs on China's goods, hoping to reduce our negative trade balance with China. Another concern is China wants to bring Taiwan under their control. We don't want that. And with the severe clash over politics, trade, and technology, we need to prevent conflict. Let's find some common ground. Thank you to President Biden for his effort. Until next week, I am John Block from Washington.
You're listening to Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Today's show is sponsored by the makers of All Grow Compost. Don't settle for expensive fertilizer when you can get nitrogen and organic matter together, all at a great price. Contact your soil health specialist, Thomas Fantozzi, at 209-312-4016. Synagro, your partner for a cleaner, greener world. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Here's another episode of the Voices of the Valley for today's interview segment. And this week's episode features a conversation about the importance of collaboration in ag tech development and the importance of coding skills for the next generation of agricultural workers.
Welcome to Voices of the Valley, a series interviewing growers, entrepreneurs, educators, and technologists who are inventing new solutions for today's and tomorrow's challenges on the farm. Brought to you by Reedley College, educating the next generation of agriculturalists in advanced technology, efficient production practices, and food safety. Now here's your hosts of Voices of the Valley, Dennis Donahue and Candace Wilson.
Welcome back to another episode of Voices of the Valley. This is Dennis Donahue. I'm the director of Western Growers Center for Innovation and Technology in Salinas, and joined once again by my good friend, Candace Wilson. Candace?
Hi, how are you? It's been a while, Dennis.
It has been. Good to be back in the saddle. And it sounds like the Western Growers annual meeting was a success and a good time had by all.
Oh my goodness. I look forward to that meeting so much every year. And it's true. It's such a everybody coming together again. It's great to see everybody's faces, hear how the families are doing. It's just, you know, it was a great event once again.
Well, it sounds like it. And next year, you know, I know the song is Viva Las Vegas, but I think everyone gets excited about the Hawaii rotation. So
we were already talking about Hawaii. That is true.
Somehow I'm not surprised. Yes. Well, we're joined by somebody else who also attended the meeting in Las Vegas, a good friend of ours. We've worked with closely over the last few years, Mike Dettinger from Trimble, who is the director of Ag OEM Development. But Mike, in your own words, you know, that's kind of a limiting title these days because you do lots of things.
Yeah, it's a title. It's what I do. I try to go out to the large OEMs and convince them to use Trimble products. But I've, in the last 3 to 5 years, actually, it extends back a little farther. I've done several special projects with Trimble that have occupied perhaps more of my time than Ag OEM development. And one of them has been working with Western Growers on the Common Modular Architecture or harvest automation.
So well, let's jump in right there, because one of the things we like to do is have our guests talk a little bit about their background and what they do. So fill us in on your background and then that kind of led up to working on the Common Modular Architecture. And I'd like you to do a couple of things when you get there. Talk about what that is and why that is. And then could you also throw in, it's important for folks to pay attention to that initiative in the sense that if there is going to be some progress on automation, that's going to be a key piece.
Okay, so that's going to require me to remember the 7 things you just asked, but
we'll go for it. I have trouble myself, so don't worry if you miss one, you'll be fine. Kansas may catch it.
Yeah, as far as background goes, I am a trained electrical engineer. I have a bachelor's and master's in electrical engineering, and I came to the Silicon Valley 40 years ago, literally, and have worked in high tech these last 40 years. The last 31 years, I've been at Trimble, which is quite the unicorn for the Silicon Valley to have someone at a company for 31 years. But that's a more complicated story. The first 19, I was in their military group. Trimble has a military group because GPS, which Trimble is fundamentally based on, that's our core element, is a military system. And we stayed very close to the military for tech reasons and still continue to build some military receivers. The last 12 years, I've been in the agriculture division. And the difference is in the military GPS, the breadth of products is narrow, but the technical complexity is extremely deep. In ag, it's almost the reverse, that the breadth of products is not as technically deep, but it's incredibly wide. We cover everything from displays to GPS receivers to rate and section controls to cabling systems to it's an incredibly wide area of engineering. So within the ag division, I came on as the hardware engineering director and then became the director of engineering for the ag division within Trimble, and then moved on to working with OEMs and then moved into more of a marketing engineering technical promotion role as the OEM development person. So my background is deep, deep tech, but my more recent experiences have been almost more in the marketing world, which, you know, is quite eye-opening. So now you wanted me to continue on to the Common Modular Architecture.
Yeah. So okay, diving into one of your special projects is the intersection with Western Growers on the automation initiative.
So it's been over 3 years since Connor Anderson, who was responsible for Trimble sales in California at the time, invited me to attend one of your ad hoc meetings about talking about harvest automation and specialty crops. And he said, hey, it's going to be in Sunnyvale. It's not far from me. Would you mind stopping by? And I stopped by and I was really impressed with the audience there. You had large companies, you had growers, you had smaller companies, you had technologists, you had people who were building equipment. And I was really, really impressed. And I attended several of these afterwards and then eventually approached both you and Walt about saying, look, we get this group together. It's really, really smart, but we talk and we have good ideas, but we're not getting traction. And so I proposed to Walt and yourself that we do a focused 12-week, I'll call it a sprint for lack of a better word, the nice software development term, where we go in and we try and peel back the complexity of this problem, this harvest automation in specialty crops. And in peeling it back, we were going to try and focus the group on what are the key elements, what are the must-win battles that are necessary to build up this industry. And we did our 12 weeks. We assembled a panel of subject matter experts, some from this original group and some from industry, where we got some roboticists, we got some, obviously, the machine builders, the growers were participating, a fair amount of tech involvement. And at the end of 12 weeks, we defined what we believe is a strategy associated with a common modular architecture that could both attract more people into this development of harvest automation for specialty crops, but also accelerate the development for the startups that were currently having to do everything. And this is one of the challenges of every startup. And this is a double-edged sword. The startups are fearless. They figure that they can do it better. That's why they're doing their thing. They're very passionate. They're very motivated. They're very smart. You know, these are really talented people. But many times they get bogged down in things that aren't related to what their real value proposition is. So if their value proposition is in AI or machine learning or, you know, some very specific aspect of harvest automation, but they feel they have to build a robot tractor in order to move their equipment down the field, they're spending time defining tires and engines and control systems that are being done commonly by many other people that they could just pick up and leverage and go. Now, for a lot of startups, this represents a conundrum because their value proposition to their investors many times is that they go out and say, hey, look, this is the size of the market. We can sell these many machines at $1 million a piece. And all of a sudden, the numbers get very, very large. Whereas if you take the common modular architecture, the conundrum is this, that if you could actually leverage a platform that's out there and you do what you do best, your total big number, you know, your total top line is going to shrink a bit because you're only doing part of the solution. The reality is, though, you're going to do your part of the solution a lot better and maybe able then to multiply into different applications because you're doing what you do best. You bring more value to that focus versus getting bogged down in the, you know, a lot of things that have already been done.
Thanks, Brian. And stay tuned as we'll have more of the day's agriculture news and farm features here on the AgNet News Hour. Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search our name of AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet West. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Farm employers' labor service compliance posters could save you thousands of dollars. Did you know that California lawmakers can be fined as much as $13,000 in government penalties if they don't have all the required employee and farm labor information posted for their workers? Avoid costly penalties and give yourself peace of mind knowing you are in full compliance with FELS posters. At only $175, this full set of laminated weatherproof posters eliminates the risk. Order yours at FELS.net.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, back again with Keith Strigler, who's a member of the program committee for the Unified Wine and Grape Symposium. Keith focuses on grape growing, but knows there's a lot to this event more than just that. Today, we're talking about some of the aspects of the trade show and what companies might be there exhibiting.
Well, just about any company that has anything to offer to the grape and wine industry is going to be there. Everything from equipment in the vineyard to trellis systems to nurseries that are selling you vines to, like I said, everything in the winery, you know, from a winemaking equipment to corks, bottles, all those kinds of things. And then, you know, things that you can use in your tasting rooms for sales. And then also, from the business end, there'll be a lot of software that's there that can help your efficiency on the business side as well. So that, and I'm probably just barely scratching the surface, but essentially anything you can think of that you need in your business will be represented by some exhibitor there at the Unified Symposium.
Now, Keith, in addition to those companies exhibiting, I can bet that there's probably going to be some wine tasting also happening at the Unified Wine and Grape Symposium. Is that correct?
There are usually opportunities to do that both formally and informally. formally, there is a tasting. There are sessions where we generally present, you know, some aspect of winemaking, and then there's a tasting of products that have been produced using those techniques, or it may be something that goes from the vineyard to the winery, and then there's an opportunity to taste some of those products. So those are the kind of things that have occurred previously, and there'll be something certainly like that this year as well. Then there's also a big tasting of wines of the U.S. I don't know if that's the title of it, but it's essentially an opportunity to taste wines that have been produced from different regions of the U.S.
Well, Keith, again, I appreciate you taking the time to chat with me today all about the event, which is taking place January 24th through the 26th. If folks want to gather more information, they should go to unifiedsymposium.org.
The deadline's approaching for submitting ballots for Farm Service Agency County Committee elections. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has sent out ballots for committee elections to all eligible agricultural producers and private landowners across the country. Producers must participate or cooperate in an FSA program to be eligible to vote in the county committee election. Producers and landowners must return ballots to their local FSA county office or have their ballots be postmarked by December 5th in order for those ballots to be counted. Newly elected committee members will take office January 1st, 2023. Each committee has from 3 to 11 elected members who serve 3-year terms, and at least one seat representing a local administrative area is up for election each year. Eligible voters who did not receive a ballot in the mail can request one from their local FSA county office. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media, at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.